Dan Doctor is going to talk about some of the additional tools. We've been hearing a lot about fairly traditional hydrologic tools, pumping tests and flow meters. And I think Dan's going to expand our repertoire here a little bit. The interesting thing about Dan is I think the Minnesota Groundwater Association actually had a big impact on him as a young student. He was here listening to Carol Kendall and Calvin Alexander talk about isotope hydrology, and that shaped a lot of his successive career. The Minnesota Groundwater Association does make a difference, apparently.
Thanks so much, Scott. It's true, and I'm really pleased and honored to be standing before you here today. It's a real homecoming for me. I got my PhD from the U under Calvin and at the Department of Geology and Geophysics. I graduated in 2002, but got here in 1994, so that shows how much I liked it here. You know, the speakers who came before me really did me a favor, because I'm not going to be able to show you the kinds of truly detailed, excellent work that they've done in compiling enormous data sets that require a huge effort in time and money and labor with limited resources to show you some real-world aquifers. I'll show you a little bit of what I did, but I really want to thank them for the work they've done and helping set up my talk, which is a bit more philosophical than data-rich, I'll admit. I do want to say thanks, recap a little bit. Martin began by showing us the theory and ended his talk by talking about the kinds of patterns in fluid flow that you can create by using relatively simple models in terms of theory, maybe difficult computationally, but they really do produce real-world patterns in fluid flow very well, the Lattice-Boltzmann models, those are. Todd Kincaid talked about getting data loggers out in the field to get detailed time series in order to view patterns in time and space. And he was able to mimic those with or calibrate a groundwater flow model to those. That's now giving a realistic impression of the complexity of the subsurface in the modeling. Really useful for managing water resources in Florida. Tony Runkel talked about fractures and bedding plane partings and those patterns that you can see related to the geologic structure in the well logs in a vertical sense. And then Kelton just finished up by talking more in a horizontal surface sense of how you see the patterns in the joints and how you can walk along an outcrop and look for where the water's flowing along those outcrops. And, of course, all of this great work here in Minnesota really hinges to a great deal, not all of it, but to a great deal on the work that Bruce and Bruce have done with the County Well Index. And I have to reiterate what others have said. I've been in the USGS in Virginia now for 3 years, and even though it's the headquarters of the USGS, we have nothing like that kind of data set in Virginia. It's really amazing that you have it. I wish I had it. There's a little bit of green envy there. And if Tony's talk about the fractures and bedding plane partings, controlling groundwater flow, didn't cause some of the modelers in the room to get bent out of shape. Now you know how this microphone felt. So like I said, I'm going to talk a little bit more philosophically about patterns and water flow, not just in karst aquifers, but in small catchments. And the reason is, after I left the U here, I went to work at the Menlo Park with Carol Kendall on studying small catchments and small catchment hydrology using tracers. So the outline of my talk will be pretty much comparing approaches to modeling groundwater and surface water and how our approaches to these models really hinges on our conceptual model of the system that we're trying to represent. My interest was in not so much creating a numerical model, but was in linking patterns in hydrology from real data, either in time or in space, to chemistry. So I wear a hat of a chemical hydrogeologist, I would say, as well as a geologist, and then a little bit of arm-waving about future directions that the field may take. For groundwater studies, really, you're starting to make a model with little data. You have wells in space, and they're often spaced far apart. Again, Minnesota's an exception. You have thousands of wells, and it's really great. But most of us don't have that kind of data density to work with. On the other hand, the physics is really well known for these more minute, microscale processes, intergranular processes, and Martin was talking about that. And so it becomes sort of a problem of scaling that up and a problem in a real sense of discretization in your model or getting some kind of real model geometry. And so, you know, I asked the question, what's real? I mean, models and the USGS's model, ModFlow, is based on a grid. And a grid is not exactly a natural pattern. But it's simple enough to allow us to calculate the known physics and to extend that through the model domain. I make maps now for a living, geologic maps, and do cross-sections for a living. So I can tell you that a cross-section like this, even though it may look very detailed and rather difficult to implement in terms of a model, this in itself is a gross simplification of what's real. And that's also something else you want to keep in mind. And so going from here to here is, I'd say, a square of the simplification. I mean that in jest, square. On the other hand, we know that some of the theory of groundwater flow is real, and we can demonstrate that by these kinds of models, these sort of bench scale models we use in introductory hydrogeology labs. We have a nice clean sand, perhaps even generated from a quarry in the St. Peter sandstone, who knows. But you can actually see that the theory of plume migration looks, and actually, if you were to calculate it, would work pretty well. The only problem is that even though this is reality in this model sense, the geology is not real. You hardly ever get a nice, clean, sorted sandstone like this without any other structures that was very carefully laid down within this model. In fact, if you go back and you look at the work that Henry Darcy did, and thanks to a fairly recent translation of his work, you'll find that when he began to do his experiments in a permeameter, he took all sediment sizes, all mixed together from the River Seine, and filled up his permeameter tube and began to do the experiments and found that the data were rather noisy. And so what he did was he turned to his assistant and he said this. He said, "Dude, we have to sieve." And he did. And he sieved to get uniform particle sizes, and only then was he able to get good data on determining a hydraulic conductivity in an empirical sense. So we're trained from a really early age to think about patterns. And this is sort of where I want to go with this talk in a philosophical sense is, you know, think about the pattern. And we are, from an early age, often rewarded for doing so, right? So look at this little diagram here. Complete the sequence, okay? Now, most 5-year-olds or even 6-year-olds would look at this and go, okay. And I kind of like this because it shows drainage of a conduit. I think of it that way. So even a 5 or 6-year-old could pick out, oh, okay, I'm going to choose this one here. That one seems to fit the pattern pretty well. So we're trained from early age to do that. And yeah, you get it right, you get a good star on your paper or extra credit or whatever. And then you go to school and you learn about porous media flow and how to calculate it. And you say, well, I think I'm going to choose this, because I can calculate that. That's a lot easier to calculate than this. And so, you know, even though it doesn't fit the pattern, that's in practice what we're doing, right? So why have we focused on mimicking some equivalent homogeneous porous media? Well, it's essentially what I like to refer as the silicon siren, that is the ability to compute. And we've gone that direction ever since we, you know, in the, well, I don't know, pick your decade, but when it became available, the computing power to solve Darcy's law and all of the great equations, other governing equations that have come out of Darcy's law, hydrogeology took a turn from the field to the desk. And I'm not the first to say this, although I think it's worth repeating, that we need to get people back into the field. Finally, one thing I'd say here, this may even be one thing a hydrogeologist may say and say, oh, well, it's there, it's just a poorly constrained boundary condition. it becomes an issue of scale, really, in terms of measurement, your data, when you want to calibrate your model. We talked about model calibrations and how it's normally you calibrate a groundwater flow model to known head distribution in the aquifer. And this has got to be the best example I know of where they've gone out and they've perforated this aquifer with piezometers, okay? They want to know what is the head distribution in this aquifer. And this is the MAID site, Columbus, Mississippi, the macro dispersion experiment. And they've actually put tracers in some of these things, and I'm not going to talk about it in great detail, but just read the conclusion here. I took it right off of Stanford's webpage. Recent studies at the MAID site have indicated that preferential flow paths resulting from aquifer heterogeneities at decimeter and smaller scales appear to have a dominant effect on plume scale solute transport. This is not karst, but this is definitely preferential flow. The kinds of hydraulic conductivities that Kelton and others have before me have talking about in conduit fractures, this is not conduit fractures. This is alluvial stringers of small channels. This is reality. And we need to begin to think that, I don't know if it's thinking, it's realizing that the approaches that we've been taking in the past have sort of been, we've almost deluded ourselves into thinking that we can reproduce groundwater flow when this is really what's happening. Okay, well, again, I'm repeating what others have said, which brings me to another type of hydrologic investigation where researchers have spent a lot of time and effort in characterizing the catchment, or the system, I should say, but with data, with real data. So, I mean, catchment studies are great because you've got lots of data. Whoops, excuse me. You've got weirs to measure the flow at various scales, from zero order to third or fourth order streams. You've got piezometers. You've got lysimeters to measure soil water. You've got rain gauges and evaporation pans. You've got, you know, snow pillows and I don't know what else. I mean, and now they've got these things they can put on towers and measure eddy fluxes. And it's amazing the kinds of data that you can collect at a catchment when you're dealing with something, let's say, less than a square kilometer of area. So more than that, the geometry of the system is really well constrained. You have really good topography control. You may even have a digital elevation model or LIDAR data, you know, to get sub-meter, maybe even decimeter scale resolution on your topography. You can map out the vegetation so you can come up with better terms for evapotranspiration. You know the surface network discreetly because it's the stream network. And you have some good characterization of the subsurface, especially if you've spent some time like they have in the Sleepers River catchment, which I'll talk about in a minute, to go around and actually poke holes in the thing, measure soil moisture, or use what they call a knocking pole to measure where the soil bedrock interface is. But what do they find in terms of governing equations for hydrologic discharge from these catchments? They can't. Okay, the physics is way too complex, and so the approach that they normally take is something very simplified, or what might be termed a lumped parameter approach. There are other terms for this, but you might get the idea. I'll mention some kinds of models later. Well, here's an example of what you might get from a small catchment study in terms of measuring soil moisture. And this was, I think, 400 or so measurements of soil moisture. Here's the stream channel. And here are the soil moistures. High is dark, low is lighter color. And if there's anything I want you to come away with from what I say today, it's this, that the surface networks we see in all these beautiful geologic maps, all these beautiful river drainages, extend underground. Okay? They keep going. Whether they're rectilinear and in cross-joint patterns or whether they're dendritic like this, they extend underground. This shows you spatial distribution of saturated hydraulic conductivities. And again, it's just a representation of what they're getting out of the soil moisture data and probably from particle size data. And you can see, again, the network extends underground. I'll come back to that. Early in the study of hydrology of catchments, you know, there was this recognition that stream flow is not simply just water running off of a Teflon surface into a channel, okay? Even though some people in mountainous catchments have used the term Teflon catchment, we now know that that's not true. And that this type of hydrograph separation, and it's only one type, I mean, you can look in textbooks and you can see different ways of of splitting up the hydrograph into event flow or recent runoff and base flow or that which is in the catchment pre-event. I won't characterize it anymore with respect to age than that, other than it was pre-event. And this is fairly typical type of hydrograph separation that you would see. We have to, a quick flow, again, assumed to be mostly precipitation, runoff generated from precipitation and slow flow. And I say, we have to stop teaching this. This is just, we're pushing undergraduates into a conceptual model that's wrong from the start. It might be simple graphically. We might be able to analyze it, but it's wrong. And why do we know it's wrong? And it's based on chemistry. Because when you look at the chemistry of those end members, the event water and the pre-event water, what you come up with is a more typical type of hydrograph separation. This is based on stable isotopes, delta O18, in the water. Groundwater is the main component of storm flow. And we talk about surface water, groundwater interactions, and what we're talking about here is this. But for the most part, surface water is groundwater. Martin started us off today talking about the derivation of the governing equations for groundwater flow. And I really liked the way he posed the problem because it was an equation that had on one side storage and the other side flux. This is the same problem that catchment people have been dealing with. What is the storage-discharge relationship? How can we characterize that? Now, for a pore space, you can use Navier-Stokes and extend Darcy's law a number of different ways. But for catchments where you have just a wide number of variables, it really comes down to simplifying it all in an empirical sense. I mean, Darcy was an empiricist, and there's no reason you can't do this for catchments either. So the basic challenge here is to find appropriate functional form that represents the hysteretic, and I'll come back to that, storage-discharge relationship and hysteresis. Hysteresis is when you see a different pattern when you're wetting up versus when you're drying, okay? Even though the physics is the same, we don't reproduce those curves, soil moisture curves. And soil physics people have had this problem for a long time, that how do you reproduce the soil moisture curve when you're wetting up a soil column and when it's drying, and when those two time series don't overlap? There's a problem that still requires a solution. Well, I was putting this talk together, unlike Tony, within the last 3 days, more or less. But I found over the weekend this wonderful paper by Jim Kirchner, who's a prominent catchment hydrologist from Berkeley, in Water Resources Research, published this month. Actually, it was October, so you can go look it up. And I think this is a huge leap forward, because what he did was he basically said, okay, our main problem is storage discharge. So I'm going to make an equation here, which is the change in storage with time, and it's a function of precipitation, which is the input to the catchment, minus evapotranspiration minus discharge. So inputs minus outputs. Okay? And he's going to couch the storage simply as a function of the discharge, and he calls it a sensitivity function. I'm not going to go into how he derived it, but essentially he says when precipitation and evapotranspiration are much less than the discharge, this sensitivity function falls out as simply this: the change in discharge with time divided by the discharge at that time period. So if you went through a time series, you calculate the slope of the hydrograph at any particular point in time that satisfies these conditions, and divided by the discharge, you can come up with this sensitivity function. Oh, by the way, you have to remember that these are all with respect to time and also as normalized for catchment area. So the units on all of these would be millimeters per time or millimeters per day, millimeters per hour, whichever you want. Now, here's the key. The reason this works well for this catchment, I'll show you how well it works in a minute, is that he chose those periods when precipitation is much less than Q, so it's not raining, and when evapotranspiration is much less than Q, so it's really not evapotranspiring either. So rainless nighttime intervals. And what he looked at was the recessions of the hydrograph in rainless nighttime intervals. And he plotted the rate of change of the discharge with time against the discharge on log-log scale, and binned together, averaged out some of the data here, and came up with a nice quadratic function. It's nearly linear, but he used a quadratic to be relatively conservative. And he doesn't say that you have to use a quadratic. He just says that's what he used for this catchment. And here's the prediction. And I have to say, I've looked at a lot of stuff, and this is pretty good. Now, he only modeled the parameters. The parameters only came from the recessions. And there weren't any parameters calibrated to the time series. This is not like cross-correlation or autocorrelation or anything like that. This is simply looking at the recessions of the hydrograph. And not only are the recessions well modeled, but so are the rising limbs of the hydrograph. I think this is pretty profound. But he wasn't the first to think about this. In fact, John Niebuhr, who's at the St. Paul, he's a professor here. I forgot which name of the department is now. Maybe it's changed. But Brutzart and Niebuhr published in 1977 a method based sort of on the same idea of looking at the recession limbs of stream hydrographs. But they were relating it back to a solution of the Boussinesq equation, which Martin introduced us to earlier today, for an idealized aquifer. Okay, and again, they came up with these parameters that they could use to model the stream flow based on flow through an aquifer. And their diagrams look something like this. Now, they didn't pick out just the rain time intervals at night. So they have two slopes here that they find, and they were only looking at the lower envelopes because they were really trying to characterize base flow. What I find interesting about this is that even with this, there's this sort of interesting transition point here where you don't have a single slope characterizing this, but you have two. And I won't talk about that anymore. I'm not really sure I understand it. I believe it falls out of the mathematics. But in any case, there is this break in slope. And here's the kind of conceptual model, the aquifer, that you would use to parameterize a model like that. But we also know that that's not true. If you look at a better conceptual model for a catchment, you have to include things like macro pores. We've heard a lot about those today. You have to include perched zones and perched aquifers. We've heard a lot about those today. And this is just in the soil, never mind the bedrock. And then you have some permanent deep aquifer. This is the part which I might take some issue with down in here, these nice simple flow lines. But nonetheless, you know, it's still a bit more complex than a simple 1D aquifer model might suggest. So how do these recessions reveal contributions from storage? Somehow they do. And we're not really understanding the physics behind it in the sense that it's very satisfactory and we can say, aha, you know, if we did a lab bench scale experiment, we could reproduce that. That's not the issue we're faced with. We're faced with what Todd was saying earlier, that we need to provide the public answers now to major questions about water supply, stream flow, water quality, and we can play in the lab to get better physical representations, better physics, governing equations, all we want. But what we really need are predictive models. And I'm of the opinion that if this works, let's use it, and let's figure out what the parameters are in the model that the model is most sensitive to, and then we can let the academics figure out why those parameters are so sensitive and apply the models to solve problems. So I think that one thing that's been a little bit underutilized, and because it's difficult and expensive, is chemistry. And the chemistry of the water as it's coming out tells you something about where the water was before it got into the stream. And so I like to use ambient tracers, isotopes, but as well as chemistry, not just isotopes, stable isotopes. So I'll show you two examples. One is the Sleepers River catchment. I've already talked about that a little bit. And then a karst example from my dissertation area in Slovenia and Italy. Sleepers River research watershed is in Vermont, up here near Danville, actually closer to the town of St. Johnsbury. And what's shown here is a sub-catchment of a larger system. It's a series of nested catchments. So here's the W9 catchment. It's only about 9 hectares. And then nested catchments above. And each of these nested catchments, the green, the red, the green, the pink, and the blue, have weirs on them. So it's a nice system in which to look at scaling of catchment flow. I'm going to focus in on a sub-watershed now. Let's see. So here is W9. And here's a sub-catchment in this catchment, even more nested. So I'm focusing now on just the very headwaters of this system. And it's very well instrumented. You can follow down the stream from, oh, I want to back up one. The stream actually begins underneath these logs right here. If you walked where I took the photo, if you walked behind me, you'd be on grass and you wouldn't even see a stream channel. But there's a stream channel just rising from below. Oh, by the way, this is a glaciated terrain of metamorphic rock. So it's primarily schist, granulites and schist. And so you've got till on top of schist. And here's the first order, or actually it's a zero order stream still. And there's the weir. And there's another weir in another catchment zero order stream here. So here it becomes a first order stream. Zero order here, zero order here. And there's a wetland here that ephemerally flows out. This is the outflow of the larger W9 catchment. And what I want to show is, if you look at the chemistry and you plot everything against everything, and I've only chosen a few here, but these are the major ions, it's actually pretty simple, okay? A hydrogeochemist like me looks at this and is like, oh, cool, this is easy. This is two-component flow. You got something over here, and you got something over here, and they mix together. How nice. Okay, let's measure where those components are. So go around, and again, this is a perforated catchment. They've got piezometers everywhere. They've got gauges and lysimeters, and we can measure the chemistry in all these places. So we've got hill slope till way out here. We've got riparian zone water over here, soil water from lysimeters over here, overland flow that occasionally you could sample, and the stream down here. Whoa, 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 wait a minute. Wait, where, what? I mean, I'm like, where's the flow, right? All right. Well, a little more focused effort, and you look at just the upper riparian piezometers. These are in hollows that are above the zero-order stream, so above where the seep begins, and in the hill slopes too. These are hollows, all of them. And here was what they look like. And back to this, okay? You sample, the stream ends here, and you sample the water underground here, and it's the stream water. You stream ends here, you sample the water up here, it's the stream water. It's just like what Todd Kincaid was talking about in the Floridan Karst, where if you go real close to the conduit and we start to look at the residence times of the water in his model, it's the short residence time stuff is real close to the conduit. And exactly analogous to here. The water that's coming into the stream is the water that's closest to the stream before the event. And we published a paper on this looking at Steve Sebastian, who is now works for the Forest Service in up near Duluth in Grand Marais. He published this paper and showed that he was interested in nitrogen cycling in the catchment. But essentially, this is a nice conceptual model of how you get water routed into the stream as you go from, this is a snowmelt event now, pre-melt into peak snowmelt. And even at peak snowmelt, you can see there are parts of the catchment that are completely disconnected from the stream. And then the question becomes, we know there's water in the hill slopes. We know it because there are piezometers that have head fluctuations and they're saturated. So how does that water get to the stream? What is the mechanism? Here you can see just stream flow in solute. So follow this gray bar through time across the hydrograph, and you'll see how the contributions of solutes in the stream actually change and tell us something about where the water's coming from and tell us something about the biogeochemistry in the stream. Really interesting, just quickly, nitrate shoots up when you get the near stream riparian zones activated. That's a biological hotspot for sure. And then as you go even expanding further away, you get organic matter, more fresh organic matter into the stream. It's a very, very dynamic system. What about preferential flow? Well, Jamie Shanley, who's worked there for probably 25 or 30 years, told me, we walked up one of these hollows and he showed me this, and he said, you know, this thing opened up about 10 years ago, and this was in 2003. He said, I've been walking through this watershed for years and years, and I've never seen anything like this, and I never even would have guessed that something like this would have formed. To me, that looks like a sinkhole, all right? But what you've got is till. This is all till. And when you stand on my hat and you look down, there's a stream flowing through here. I can't think of anything more analogous to karst than this. And here we are in a metamorphic terrain with till on it, glaciated metamorphic terrain. The point is, preferential flow is the rule. We've heard it before. and we can't ignore it, and we have to come up with a better way to deal with it. And you can see those macrophores. You can walk around in the organic matter. There's tree roots. There are subsurface streams everywhere. You can see macropores in the till from root casts and things that feed water into the smaller streams. It's a network. The whole thing's a network. Forget about matrix flow. Don't forget about it. Don't forget about it. But don't think that that's what you really need to model, because what you really need to model is this stuff. Okay, which brings us to karst, which, of course, is the poster child for preferential flow. And, I've seen lots of karst in lots of different places. This is an image from the Karin fields up on the classical karst in Slovenia. This you might recognize as outcrops in southeastern Minnesota. We've seen lots of those. Mystery Cave, which I've spent some time in. Here again is Slovenia. This is the Skojan Cave. There's a little town of Skocjan. That's a church steeple for scale. Huge, huge mega dolinas, mega sinkholes here with a river flowing through that, when you get into the cave, flows through the cave, and there's a bridge right here for scale and a little footpath that you can follow on the tour. And then there's me in Virginia, and I threw this in, and we were talking about fractures, subhorizontal fractures or bedding plane partings. These are not bedding planes. These are fractures related to a fault zone. But look at the karst features. This is flow beginning, initiating along that fracture and then eating its way up into the limestone. These are clearly rising flow paths. You get into the caves and they're all like that, phreatic up, and they initiate at these bedding plane partings. So, chicken and egg problem aside, clearly these things are flowing not just in unsaturated zones, but also in the deep saturated zone. Now, for karst, we generally have good discharge data. I mean, people have been gauging springs for a really long time. Of course, we have a very poorly constrained geometry in most places except Minnesota now, thanks to the County Well Index. And joints and things, and we're working on that, getting more structural data. What are the governing equations? Well, pick your favorite, because just about anyone can apply depending on where you are. But here's a conceptual model, so I like to put pictures in our minds here. And I'm going to throw this up just to help you out here. If you looked at the recession of discharge with time and you took a log of it, one of the things you find in karst more than in other places is that you get these linear segments to the recession. But they have different slopes at different times. And early on, it was interpreted that this would have been the fast flow portion, the real open conduit portion, where you have a real fast recession as heads drop very quickly through an open conduit, and that the lower base flow portion would have been these smaller fractures of the matrix, perhaps, if you had a high matrix porosity, flowing out and giving you your base flow. But what's intriguing to me, and is always intrigued me and been interesting, is that you have this intermediate segment, which is also linear in a fairly long duration. And this made people struggle. Okay, well, how do we explain this? And they went from, well, it's a system of stacked linear reservoirs that kind of drain out, but that really doesn't work when you try to model it. Then people have modeled it with just a matrix, and you put line sinks as conduits, and they can say, yeah, we actually can model three recession segments just using a porous media aquifer model with discrete fracture zones. But I've seen their results, and they look nothing like this, because they all stack up. Their three segments are like, there's almost no discrimination between them. So I'm still skeptical of that work too. Nonetheless, let's just look at it from this aspect of, you have fast drainage, you have an intermediate rate of drainage, and you have a slow rate of drainage. That's what that says. And here's a real world example. Here's a hydrograph. You have a fast drainage, perhaps the conduit portion. You have something intermediate, and you have this diffusive flow drainage, which may even have diurnal periodicity in it, related to whatever in the base flow, perhaps evapotranspiration. And people have tried to, well, okay, I'll skip that. I like this too, I like this approach, but one thing that struck me from looking at these things is that we struggle with storage, right? We want to know what's the storage-discharge relationship. So what's nice about these linear segments is that they're in log space, that is. If you extrapolate them back to when there was peak flow, you can calculate, albeit theoretically, a volume of storage. So that would be perhaps your base flow volume of storage, extrapolating that rate of recession back, and assuming that the water coming out at that rate of drainage represents some discrete compartment, so to speak, in the aquifer. And then there's this intermediate segment, and you can, again, calculate the storage volume and then the fast flow. But of course, in reality, the fast flow here is a combination of all of these, right? And this intermediate is a combination of these. Only when you get into the real base flow are you pretty confident that you're measuring something. That if you were to look at its chemical signature, you would say, oh, that's coming from a fairly discrete reservoir. Now here we get into the patterns. If this is true, if you can characterize these storage compartments based on their chemistry, then those patterns ought to be there, and they ought to be reproducible. And so this is what was driving me in my research for my PhD, which I did in Slovenia. I went over to look at the classical karst aquifer. It was a fairly well-studied, well-constrained aquifer system down here in southwestern Slovenia. And actually, this is the border between Slovenia and Italy. So it's actually a cross-boundary aquifer system. And here's just a real simple diagram about the places you'll see and a bit of the hydrologic setting. So it's an uplifted limestone plateau, pretty flat, no surface drainage to speak of at all. Everything's draining internally, all the rainfall. It gets about a meter and a half of rain a year. But what's interesting is off here, there's siliciclastic rocks, flish, interbedded sandstones and shales that this river Reka flows off of and hits the karst and sinks at those caves I showed earlier with the steeple and the church and the big sinkholes. And that river underground, that's right here. That river flows underground and actually flows out to these springs over here on this side. Now off to the north, there are a couple of other rivers. This one in particular, the Socha River, is a large stream that drains an alpine area. And there were some dye traces that have been done ever since the early 1900s. Very interesting system. Rates of flow through here are on the order of 40, 50 meters per day. This is almost a 40-kilometer distance that you're traced across. So we know that there's a general hydrologic gradient that goes from here to here. And then there has been postulated for a long time losses of this river that come out these springs as well. Now, that's been never dye traced because it's an alluvial plain, but nonetheless, from stable isotope work primarily, you can see that there's an influence of this river on these springs. I'll blow this up a little bit. It's a resurgence zone of many springs, but the main springs are the Tamavo, and I'm going to talk about those here. Okay, and then there are these wells, and these are worth noting as well. This is, I'll go back one or two. There were a series of wells drilled through here to try to find a water supply, and only one of them was finally determined to be productive enough to warrant a production for the area. And this is a borehole. So I sampled these very frequently during the time I was there. Here's a Tamavo Springs and Mefer scale during low flow event time period, and here's Tamavo during high flow. Its mean annual discharge, and sorry for the units, we keep switching around on you, is about 9 meters cubed per second, and it gets up to over 150 meters cubed per second. It's a lot of flow. So what did I do? I went out and sampled all those springs and the boreholes and the river to try to find the end members that could be the sources of flow to the streams. And fairly frequently in time, I started out going out monthly, and I was like, oh, well, here's the hydrograph. I'm not doing good enough. And so I tried to do twice a month, and even then, I wasn't doing a very good job of representing the hydrograph. So it wasn't out until I got to just about the end of my time there that I had the wherewithal and the resources to sample a couple of really big events. And then I stopped, and of course, I got the 100-year flood event right here. So I don't have any data, but I did leave a data logger in there. What's really interesting is that borehole B3, which was the monitoring well, drilled very close to the production well, really doesn't change at all. And I was like, cool, there's an end member. Okay, there's some part of the system that is always there, and it's got a real consistent chemistry. I can use it as an end member. And what it ends up being is recharge water, autogenic recharge, rainfall that's interacted with the soil and the limestone and sat there. Basically, that's what it is. And there's the event sampling there. Oh, this yellow is the Socha River, that one river that's been postulated to feed the springs, and this is its stable isotope. And what a record here. And if you look at the seasonality, it's kind of interesting. In the warmest months, of the year, it's got the lowest delta O18 signatures, which is kind of inverted from what you normally think. If you think cold precipitation, you usually think lower delta O18. And the reason this is because the water that's in the river at this time has been snowmelt from the mountains up to the north. So it's bringing in a nice distinct chemical or isotopic signal in the river flow that you can take advantage of here. Okay, here's the kind of discharge record for the Tomavo Springs I had available to me. I was sampling in this time period, but the best recession I could find was this one here. And you really would like not to have the recession interrupted by subsequent events, but that didn't really seem to interfere with the overall rate of recession into base flow. So I admit I'm removing these as smaller events, but since the slope of this, as you'll see in a minute, didn't change overall, I'm assuming that this is representative of the long-term recession. And that's a good long period of time. Okay, we're talking this 1997 to 98. That's almost a year. Okay, and there's that broken out in log space. And really, you find nice breaks in slope and intermediate segments. Now, I was able to identify four of these, and not just in this long-term recession, but several others that I laid on top of each other, and then came up with some, for these segments, models of exponential functions that describe, if you take it out of log space, it's an exponential. But what I was really interested in, not so much these exponentials, but the breaks in the slope. And I'll tell you why, because I wanted to find a way to break up the flow regimes in order to look at the chemistry to relate it back to those storage compartments that feed the spring under different hydrologic conditions. So I just, real simple approach, I said, okay, I see these breaks in slope. They're reproducible. They're real. I don't know what they represent, but I'm going to use them to delimit flow regimes and see if I find chemical patterns. So there you go. I just basically cut the hydrograph into space like this for different flow regimes and took the chemistry that I had collected on the recessions only and grouped them together. And patterns, really interesting patterns fell out. For example, for delta O18, when it was in flood flow, high flow, you had the higher delta O18 values. And as it got down to base flow, you got these lower delta O18 values. And that felt like good because it kind of supported the hypotheses about that river Socha feeding the springs under base flow conditions. Other people had hypothesized as much as 50% of the water under base flow was coming from that river. And I was able to corroborate that with these chemical data. There were some other interesting patterns with respect to chemistry. But I was able to do this sort of on a mean annual scale. And Todd mentioned earlier about the water budget. I had to start there to say, okay, these are the mean annual flows. This is the amount of water. Now I'm just going to relate the chemistry back to these. But on an event scale, this is where the rubber really meets the road. This is where you can actually see the system in its dynamic action. You're not averaging out anything. You're just looking at it, what's happening through time. And so here, for a month, I was sampling. Well, early on, I was sampling three times a day at a well. And this well was intersecting a conduit, and it was the same water supply conduit that fed the pumping well for the water supply of the citizens on the Cross region. So here are all the kind of data that I got, and these are the patterns that fall out. Interestingly enough, some things are anti-correlated with the hydrograph and other things are not, and there's some other weirdness in here. And so I struggled quickly with how do I put all this together? You know, it's rather complex. The first thing you do is you plot up these bivariate diagrams. You plot one thing against the other, and you see if anything falls out. In this case, I could plot my N members over here. So here's that river, Socha River. Here's that karst water. That's that well that really didn't change any chemistry at all and was representing that autogenic recharge. Here's something I didn't really know existed, but I had some data from some caves that had been sampled very, very occasionally, which had really high chloride. And that's the only thing that really stood out. And this other river here that fed in from the western part of the karst, if you remember, was sort of a mix in between these. So that was really difficult to discern. Nonetheless, what fell out of the patterns on those, well, there was multiple hydrographs here. Go back. Okay, so there were two main periods of hydrographs in here. That's what I want to show. And this third rise. So that's how these are broken out. The water starting from one place, moving over, coming back, moving over, coming back, and so forth. Actually, it starts here, and then on the decreasing limb, it goes up towards this end member. So black is on the rising limb going this way, and then the recession limb is the open circle. And then it started again. It jumped down to here, and recession came over to here, and then it rose again. Combining these all with a method called principal components analysis enables you to take multiple parameters and reduce them. Reduces them to those that contain the most variance, the highest variance of the data set. And that's a statistical analysis is generally called factor analysis. You can take those factors then that represent the major variability in all the data and do what's called an n-member mixing analysis. I'm not going to talk about the details. I've got a paper you can read if you'd like, which explained in more detail how to do this. But basically, you're taking these things and putting it into a sort of a multi-parameter space and choosing out the principal components here statistically. Here's the first principal component. Here's the second. And here are the n-members. And here's all the well samples that are through here. And in this two-dimensional space now, I can calculate, because it's a ternary diagram, a proportion for each of these points and say, oh, this point here is X percent karst water, Y percent of this anthropogenic component, and Z percent of the Socha River. And then you can plot up through time how those percentages are changing across the hydrograph and really see where is the water coming from that's in the stream at any given point in time across the hydrograph. And, of course, you have to do a check on how well it's reproducing your observed data. So you transform the model data back into the original parameters, and you get fairly good fit. In fact, really good for chloride and really good for oxygen, except in the very far ends of the recession limbs. And then it gets messed up for calcium and a little messed up for delta C13 of DIC. That's basically, you think of it as your alkalinity. But these two things I wouldn't expect to be very easily reproducible anyway because, well, you've got all these waters that are at varying saturations with respect to calcite in the aquifer, so this could just be random noise in the data. Okay, so back to recessions. So if this works, if you can look at this for a well, for example, and apply this method with chemistry, can you apply this to different scales? These are spring hydrographs, and what I want to point out is in order for you to kind of work with this method, you need to first identify patterns in your data. And so something like this, where you have multiple spring hydrographs and segments of the hydrographs that have relatively similar ranges of recession coefficients for the different segments, is a good thing, because then you pile them on top of each other and you can say, okay, this is a representative pattern. You can see them in springs, you can see them in wells. This is another example from a well. And then how about here in Minnesota? And now I'm not really arm-waving about this, but I just pulled up some data from the Upper Iowa River, which is sort of near the border between Minnesota and Iowa down south. And if you plot it on log scale, the discharge, you actually can identify breaks in slope that are rather intriguing. When I first started doing some research here in the karst in Minnesota, I had instrumented some drips in Mystery Cave following in the footsteps of Calvin's former graduate student, Roy Jameson. And plotting out, again, the natural log of the discharge in these cave drips, I can come up with these segments that are intriguingly similar in their recession coefficients. I asked Matt Covington earlier, is there a spring we could try to look at this, and maybe we can see that the recession coefficients are telling us something about scale-independent behavior through this area. So why are they there in the first place? Well, I don't know. I don't know, but I have a feeling that looking at the structural characteristics of the rocks and caves may give us some indication about why water might suddenly shift from one rate of drainage through the system to another rate of drainage through the system. And it may have something to do with abrupt breaks in the conduits that are actually feeding water to the stream. So here's the street. Here's the passage of the cave, and these are the side passages. Now there's a quite a big step difference between this size and this size here. And so I tried to get my hands on a data set that might show this in a little more detail, and Art and Peg Palmer have mapped Blue Spring Caverns in Indiana. They mapped all the passages, measured them all themselves, so there's some measure of consistency in how the data were obtained. And what you see in this plot here is aperture width of the cave passages versus their frequency. And there's a break in frequency here just below 1.5 meters, which I found intriguing. And if you plot it on the log scale, you kind of see that there's a relatively linear segment there and one there that ends up being less than 0.5 meter. What is this? I really don't know, but I'm really arm-waving and thinking that maybe these are multiple fractal dimensions that we're seeing in the conduits of themselves. That's all I'll say about that. But finally, the preferential flow is the norm. We see it everywhere. We see it in the vadose zone, roost cast, burrows, desiccation cracks. Interflow, this is lateral flow between the water table and the surface, where permeability changes drastically across soil bedrock interfaces, or where you have bentonite layers in layered Paleozoic carbonates and sandstones and shales. Interflow is important. Even in alluvium, we have sand and gravel channels, and they've just demonstrated that at the MADE site. Bedrock, of course, even granites have fracture flows, karst has conduit flows, and Dave Kolstad here in his research group has even shown some evidence that based on looking at water and the distribution of water and minerals in the mantle, there may even be channel flow in this large convecting solid in the mantle. So I like to think of things as moving through channels. What are the patterns in hydrology that we can look to in the future for trying to tease out some of this stuff? Well, I've already talked about recession slopes of hydrographs. I think they're really important and interesting. Hysteresis needs to be worked on, for sure. There's the whole problem of diurnal periodicity, some of it related to biologic effects at the land surface, and some of it not. Fractal networks, there's a lot of study on that, and it's mostly empirical work, but for the most part, we recognize them. We just haven't figured out a way to effectively implement them yet, and these power law relations that we see in time series as well. How to link chemistry to discharge? I think you look at these patterns and you begin to take enough chemistry in time series across these hydrologic patterns and we'll begin to make inroads into understanding why these things exist. What lies ahead? I like this quote from George Hornberger and Beth Boyer. George was former president of the AGU hydrology section, and Beth Boyer is now a professor at Penn State. And I worked with her at Sleepers River. Steve Sebastian was her student, PhD student. And they say, it may seem strange to end a review of modeling, this was catchment modeling, with an observation that future progress is linked to the acquisition of new data and new experimental work, but that's the state of the science. And that was 1995, and I think that's still true today, and we've seen some talks that have gone a long way towards demonstrating that. We need high-frequency data collection. It's never been easier. It's never been cheaper. Todd was saying the money we spend to get a groundwater age date with tracers like noble gases or chlorofluorocarbons, even though that's good work, we could buy a data logger and we could have, you know, years of data. I think that's a better way to go about it. There's newer technology out there, these wireless distributed sensors that you sprinkle out in the environment and they talk to each other as they make measurements. That's new stuff that's going on in USGS and Menlo Park. And data-based modeling is essentially making a model from all these data sources. I think what all of this is leading us towards is a rebirth of empirical methods for understanding hydrology. Okay, back to Darcy's permeameter. He took a lot of data to come up with his law, which is essentially just a more or less a statistical fit to point data. And now, what if Darcy had a data logger? That's kind of what I like to think is, what would he have come up with? How would he have viewed the way he was conducting his experiments? Well, we have that capability today, and I think we ought to implement it. And some other new ways to look at applying empirical models are through kernel functions, which is really not new, but through the process of convolution integrals, you can take time series and apply a particular function and make it as a filter to do input-output. You don't really know why you're getting the output that you're getting to fit, but it fits, and it's a good way to predict what will happen in the future. Another way to do that is artificial neural networks. Again, you don't know the physics behind it, but this is a way to train some system based on real data to reproduce what you're seeing, and then test it against untrained new data. And then the kind of lattice-Boltzmann models. This is much more physically based. However, there is, I think, some room in there to apply a bit of empiricism, if I may. Well, we can talk about that, Martin and I. Thanks very much. Appreciate your patience. Well, just quick answer to your question. There are geothermal springs in the area, but very mild geothermal springs. It's a highly tectonic zone. It's still actively tectonic today. I don't think the correlations are related to that. I think they're more related to movement downward of water that's in an epiphreatic aquifer. I like to think of it as that. It's sort of the epicarst and the zone above the water table that is still spongy and holds a lot of water. But yes, you're seeing these correlations because you have these sources, basically the phreatic system and this epiphreatic system interacting across hydrographs and conditions. Yeah, Martin. Exactly, yes. I think it's the latter, that you have multiple fractal dimensions working in concert. Initially, okay, and I think that the joints that Kelton was talking about earlier, that would have had a single fractal dimension if it was just the deformation of the rock with joints. And you can look at other studies that have mapped fractures and their sizes and their distributions, and that would be a single continuous function. But when you route water through it, eventually you get to this point in karst where there's this critical threshold. And when you break through, you get into turbulence, and you start to open up some of them preferentially to another, and you could put yourself into the regime of a new fractal dimension beginning to evolve. And that's how I look at it. Questions? Thanks very much.